welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gather to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at Providence Hospital for a health talk on rethinking the Thanksgiving feast. Dr. Ross Tanner, the founder of the Diabetes and Lipid Clinic of Alaska, gave his 10 tips for holiday eating at the Providence Cancer Center in Anchorage on Monday, November 15th.
Hello, everybody. It looks like everybody came here to eat. That's what this kind of meeting turns out to be. There's no turkey tonight. I've got two mics. I got one for radio, I got one for TV, and I got one for you guys. So I think everybody's anticipating some great conversation, hopefully with the audience today, about some important information. And it's something I've been pretty passionate about for about 20 years. I've been practicing. And part of my background is also I'm married to a diabetic, and my dad has had type 1 diabetes for 50 years. So some of the things I'm going to share with you are some things practical that I've learned through the years. How to be good and bad. I don't like using those words because it connotates some responsibility, and we're all irresponsible to some extent on Thanksgiving, which can be good and bad. Some of the things I'm just going to talk about generalities. There's some very specific things that I will tell patients individually based on if they're a type 1 diabetic, if they're a type 2 diabetic, depends on their age, and also depends on what I think their challenges are. Some people don't follow any plan, and some people are very, very stringent with their plans, and they're looking for additional information. So kind of keep that in mind. So on Thanksgiving, you have a few choices if you're a diabetic. And I'll include under, when I say the word diabetic, this will be inclusive to type 1 and type 2 diabetics, but also the pre-diabetic. And there's probably about, I say in the United States, there's about 28 million diabetics, and there's probably 65 to maybe up to 100 million pre-diabetics. And you think about the sheer number of our population of 270 million people, you're talking about there's a lot of people challenged with metabolic consequences of what diabetes or pre-diabetes is. Now, last time I was at Providence, I gave a talk about diabetes in general, about how does one become diabetic, how do you actually treat diabetes with some general nature as far as medications, as well as diet, as well as physical activity. I am not one of those persons to give you unrealistic ultimatums, but we're going to go through about 10 slides is all I have. And these are the things I think if you had a few choices, you can stay at home, and you not celebrate with your family and loved ones, which is not a reasonable thing to do, but that's an option. And some people actually prefer that over meeting with some family. But these are your options that I kind of see. You can sleep in late and watch the Macy's Day Parade. That's an option. My nurse today actually told me this is what he was going to do. You can watch Texas A&M beat University of Texas, which I guarantee you that's what I'm going to do. Watch that. I played football for A&M, so I'm pretty passionate about that. You can make sure you have a game plan as a healthy diabetic, and part of that is actually just strategizing what are your challenges. You know, for men, I think most of us, we eat too much, we eat too fast, and we eat too late. That's generally, not to stereotype every man, but generally that's the way we did it when we were 16 years old. So if we're 48 years old or if we're 68 years old, it's very hard to break some of those traditions. But what happens is our metabolism starts to slow. Testosterone in men starts to go through changes. Women go through certain changes hormonally. And these behaviors that we learn as younger adults don't necessarily always are conducive for actually being healthy as we get older. So I just, that's what I do. Do a game plan on what are you going to do for that day. And these things that I'm going to share with you today are not really any different than what I tell patients to do on just a standard day. So the main thing is, and Meg was talking to me earlier about this before this talk, I said, what's the number one thing you tell people? Well, we need to come up with a non-punitive plan of action. You can't go through life saying, I can't have this, I can't have that, because there's certain things that we're going to like, whether it be bread, whether it be pasta, whether it be ice cream, whether it be pumpkin pie on Thanksgiving, whatever it is, you can't have a punitive plan of action. You got to have something that also builds up durability over a long period of time, because most patients will go on, what's your blood type diet, what is a tea and toast diet, the HCG diet, I've heard them all. And basically it's taken a lot of people that have certain vulnerabilities and putting together a strategy that I don't think is really good of trying to have short-term goals of trying to lose so much weight in a certain amount of time before high school reunions or weddings or whatever it is. But you got to figure out what your motivation is. Part of your motivation is, like I told the person today, I said, look, she was very slow on losing her weight. She's lost about 20 pounds since about 07, but she was gaining about 20 pounds a year prior to that. So I said, well, you really lost 40 pounds if I look at it that way, because you're gaining 20 pounds per year. But I said, look what you did. Your cholesterol is perfect. Your diabetes is perfect. Your blood pressure is perfect. You're on half as many drugs, and you're doing it with using medications to complement your behavior in a non-punitive, durable plan of action. So whether it be just one day, or whether or not it be a lifetime, or whether it be for the next 3 months, you got to figure out what you need to do for that. So I thought I would go through just some basic statistics. Now, I don't like going through all these statistics because it can be boring for a lot of people, but I want you to understand what we're focused on, at least in the state of Alaska, and what we're spending on diabetes. And if you think we spend a lot on healthcare now, wait till it's free and wait till all these pre-diabetics become diabetic. It's going to be enormous. And because diabetes is not a glucose problem, it's a vascular problem. Every diabetic is going to mature into a vascular patient at some point in time. And it's estimated probably about 10 to 15 years before they were going to have some vascular event, they're going to develop that problem. In general, some people earlier, some people later. But there's almost $420 million spent annually in the state of Alaska through direct and indirect costs, through loss of work, medications, lots of different things, hospitalizations, things like that. So quite a bit. And I have some, if people want to know more of these statistics, I can give you resources for this. I think I put it on my last page of the slides, but this all comes from our taxpayer dollars pay for this, gathering this data through the health department. Just Medicaid expenditures themselves. You can see, now this is type 2 diabetes. In children, we spend $2.5 million a year on children that are type 2 diabetics, not type 1, which is juvenile onset diabetes where the pancreas just quits working. We're getting younger and younger people getting diabetes because we're becoming more and more obese as a society, and our diet has changed a lot. And all we're doing is we've increased diabetes, but what we've done is we've expressed our genetic or our ethnic predisposition to become diabetic by becoming more sedentary and more overweight. So it starts at the grade school level for sure. I mean, I go to my kids' elementary school, I see what they eat, we see menus, we see things as far as Coke machines and candy and stuff like that. A lot of that stuff's been eliminated as we become more aware of what our children are eating, but also children are growing up with bad habits. And I think about when I was younger, there's maybe a couple kids in my class that are overweight out of about 100 kids in my high school. And I think about, and of course, you know, I know there's bigger schools and more ethnically diverse populations. It depends on where you grew up at. But as we're seeing more and more kids, and I'll show you some obesity trends in the state of Alaska, this is going to have huge implications. And this has to do a lot with our diet. And some of the things, rather than saying, don't eat this, don't eat that, do this, rather than doing that, we have to come up with a creative way of being healthy. Adults, we spend $43 million. This is our money spending on people that don't have insurance on taking care of them. And these are direct costs. So you're looking at quite a bit of money per year. If you look at other things as far as lost productivity, 10% are unable to work, which is about six times what the average population is that aren't diabetic. 46% of people have disability, which is about four times more than non-diabetics. And diabetes itself is the seventh leading cause of mortality, with cardiovascular disease being number one, which one of the major risk factors for cardiovascular disease is actually diabetes and the associated things that come along with it, with hypertension and also high cholesterol. So if we look at things that include a thing called metabolic syndrome, which is five things. It's increase in waist circumference, so we gather weight around our midsection, high triglycerides, which is a cholesterol, type of cholesterol in our blood, low good cholesterol, high blood pressure, and diabetes. Those are the five things that make up metabolic syndrome. But all of these things in a continuum actually make up the pre-heart disease patient or the pre-stroke patient. So if we just focus on diabetes, but we don't focus on blood pressure, we don't focus on cholesterol, there are a lot of people taking Lipitor and those kinds of drugs, and they're still smoking. Or it's people taking lots amount of drugs for their diabetes and their cholesterol, but they're still not following a dietary program. It may look better on paper by using medications, but medications should always be used to complement one's change in behavior if that's their problem. Not every diabetic is deserving of the disease. Sometimes they do everything right and the glucose is still abnormal. I see that all the time. So when I look at these, some of these numbers, we're talking about what it, how it affects Alaskans and what it's going to cost in the future, because I think my next slide here shows kind of what obesity is. So since 2006, there's been a prevalence of diabetes among obese Alaskans that is 6 times higher than non-obese adults. So as we overindulge, not just for Thanksgiving, but just our nature in general as a society, we're 6 times more likely to have diabetes if we're obese. And 60% of Alaskans are obese, and 27,000 Alaskans are actually diabetic, which has been a 63% increase since 2001. And it's on an exponential curve. It's not linear. It's not going to just keep increasing 10% or 15% a year. It's just you got all these pre-diabetic patients that are actually maturing into diabetes. And I've been doing this 20 years. I'll probably do it another 10 to 15 years. And I don't have the capacity in my clinic to take care of all the people that are going to be diabetic. And there's going to be Medicare patients, Medicaid patients, uninsured, insured patients. There's going to be lots of need to take care of these folks. It's going to get more and more expensive to take care of them. So prevention is the name of the game if you haven't focused on what I've been saying. So in the 2007-2008 school year, 18% of kids in the Anchorage School District were considered obese, and 75% of these children will become diabetic. When I was in training 25 years ago, I never saw a type 2 diabetic that was under 20 years of age. Never. I've never seen that. And it's probably the fastest growing population of diabetics. Still, the highest prevalence of diabetics is after the age of 60, so it keeps going up every decade of life. So there's a lot more people as we get older have diabetes, but the type 2 diabetic that is 60 and 70 years of age is a lot different than the 15-year-old or 20-year-old diabetic. Type 2 diabetes is generally an adult onset process, and it's been reported as low as 5 years of age. And it was in Texas. A friend of mine was actually one of the doctors on that case. It was a Hispanic child. So a high ethnic group as far as propensity of developing diabetes. And again, the kid at 5 years away, age weighed 125 pounds. So, you know, it's an epidemic and it's getting worse. So let's just talk about some practical things that we can do for Thanksgiving. I thought this is kind of like the David Letterman list of 10 things, but I don't really care for David Letterman, so I didn't want to reference him. But have Thanksgiving at your house, because you're more in control in your house. If you go to somebody else's, it's like if my mom makes some, my mom's from the South and she makes chicken fried steak and some of those things, I'm not going to walk inside and say, well, why'd you make that again? Because I won't probably ever get fed again. So I just, you know, you're more control in your house of what's being served if you're going to be making things. If people want to bring things, you can't control that. But at least you know there are going to be some things on how you prepare the turkey or whatever you guys eat that's going to make it a little bit more conducive for being healthy. Eat a good breakfast. This idea of I'm not going to eat anything until noon and save up this huge appetite so I can just eat more makes no sense at all. And I'll talk about that in just a minute. Eat small snacks prior to the main meal so we're not so hungry going into the main meal. One of the things I do is when I work, I get to work about 6:15, 6:30. I'll eat breakfast around 5:30 or so. I'll eat maybe a small snack during the daytime. But when I get home, I'm hungry. And so one of the first things I do is I don't walk in the door and make a plate of food. What I do is my wife will make my plate. And it's not a chauvinistic thing, because she'll get a small plate and make small servings. I get a big plate and get big servings. Because I'm starving, I've been hungry all day, and I've been occupied by talking to people all day, like now, and I'm not hungry right now, but when I go home and sit down and have some idle time, I may be more hungry. So I don't set myself up for failure, and so that's what I'm going to do on Thanksgiving as well. Just eat some small snacks. I'll have my wife make my plate. She never lets me make her plate because I put too much food on it. If you're diabetic, check your blood sugar several times during the day. A lot of times that can be motivating. So if I check my glucose and my sugar is 350, I may be a little bit more conscious of what I'm going to do when I sit down to eat some more food, because it's just a buffet all day long, you know. And so checking the blood sugar for patients that are diabetic actually is motivating to some extent. The worst thing you can do is just don't check it, don't take the medicines, eat whatever you want, say this is just one day of year. The problem is those one day of year happen every month, and your cumulative over a period of time starts adding up to having bad things happen to your health. And then prepare extra side dishes that are healthy. I mean, you got candied yams, you got, you know, stuffing that's bread, you got, and there's lots of different things that are actually on a Thanksgiving table that make it a little bit harder to behave as a person that may be pre-diabetic or even diabetic. Sugar-free desserts. You know, does anybody remember Tab in the 70s and how that stuff was nasty? I mean, it just wasn't a diet drink kind of person. It was just nasty stuff. But as things have gone from saccharin to NutraSweet to Splenda to other sweeteners, I mean, you got stevia, these sweeteners are getting, you could talk about, you know, natural sweeteners and unnatural, whatever you want, but as the sweeteners get better, a lot of things like NutraSweet, if you actually use NutraSweet and you heat it, it denatures and has a bitter taste to it. So Splenda, that's why you see Splenda for baking, because there's things that you can add Splenda and replace the sugar or make it half and half to where it tastes pretty good. I mean, and again, being married to a diabetic and being raised by a diabetic, and growing up in the South, everybody had tea in the refrigerator. Everybody had iced tea. Well, or Budweiser, either one. I guess you could pick your one. But so we just had unsweetened tea. And if you put any kind of sugar in tea, it's just, you know, if you want sweet tea in Texas, be very careful if you're diabetic, because it's probably, you might as well go ahead and have the pumpkin pie, because there's lots and lots of sugar in it. But I think as these sugar-free desserts and these sweeteners have come around, it's made recipes, and you just go on the internet. I'm going to show you some access points in a minute for some websites and give you the address that you can look things up. Very easy to do this. And our taste buds are very interesting. We like salt, we like fat, and we like sweet things. And if you eat those things all the time and you start eating healthy, the food doesn't taste nearly as good because you don't have that culinary experience. And people either crave salt, they crave carbs, or they do both. And as you start to deplete that, if I drink sweet tea or if I have something salty, it's just not edible because I'm not used to eating those kinds of things. So I'm not trying to say you can never have those kind of things, but most of the time if you actually get used to things that like these healthy portions, these sugar-free desserts, and you're eating correctly, and you go eat at McDonald's and have a Big Mac and French fries, it'll probably make you sick because your body's not adapted to that environmental crap, is what I call it. So I got a funny story about McDonald's. I share this usually when I give diabetic talks. I've got twins that are in, now they're in third grade, and I've got a son in fourth, he's one grade ahead. So my twins go on a field trip, and I get this call at my office from the teacher, and the teacher's calling me and says, and I'm thinking he's hurt, you know, because he's always doing something like jumping from here on his, you know, that kind of thing. So, and she says, nothing's wrong, nothing to alarm you, but your son won't eat and we're out on a field trip. I said, where are you at? He goes, we're at McDonald's. I said, ooh, good, this sounds good. I said, what did he tell you? He says, my dad's a diabetic doctor who says we don't eat this stuff. I'm like, awesome. So, you know, we can all program these children early on. And I'm not a Nazi with this. I mean, they do have, you know, chocolate. And they do have their different, at least it's not within a couple hours of going to bed. But I mean, there's certain things we do to let them enjoy and experience some of the foods that, whether it be ice cream or things like that. But as adults, I think we can show the same example of what we can show them by eating correctly. The next thing is avoiding alcohol. And I didn't know about avoiding alcohol and avoiding stress, which order I should put that in, because sometimes the family members need the alcohol. And so it can alleviate some of your stress. But alcohol is a sugar. It depending on which one you have, whether it be beer, wine, or actually straight liquor, I mean, it can have a significant effect on your glucose. And so it's probably better if you're trying to consume a diligent amount of carbohydrates to watch how much you're eating cumulatively. So if there's alcohol, if there's breading with stuffing, if there's dessert, if there's, you know, what are you eating? You got to kind of limit. And alcohol is one of the things you can have anytime, I guess, if depending on your religion and your beliefs and things like that. But the thing is, I'm there to enjoy some carbs. And I think that alcohol is one of those things that probably is better just to avoid. And then fitting some type of exercise, not just on Thanksgiving, but a lot of times if you fit walking into your exercise program or on a daily Thanksgiving program, you know, a lot of times I get creative with that and say, do something to interact with my children. I mean, if we're going to eat Thanksgiving dinner, maybe beforehand as they're all hovering in the kitchen and bugging my wife, I'll take them outside and do something. Even, you know, Alaska, you can go outside, obviously, even if it's depending on how cold it is. Or in between Thanksgiving meal and dessert, I'll wait a couple hours, and I've got some slides on this in just a second, and do something in that interim and just burn off some of these calories so you don't have that tryptophan experience from the turkey and start getting sleepy and sitting around and watching the Aggies beat University of Texas. So, all right, so if you want to save your appetite for the big Thanksgiving meal, like I said, please don't do that, because you're just going to overeat. And the way the body processes foods, everything is broken down into glucose. So carbohydrates go to glucose, protein goes to glucose, and fat goes to glucose. 1 gram of fat has got twice as many calories than a gram of protein or carbohydrates. So people that are on these low carbohydrate diets, these real low carbohydrate diets, you gotta eat something. Unless you're eating celery and water, you gotta have something that's gotta have some caloric value to it. So you can have a low, low carb diet and still eat 4,000 calories a day. And when the Atkins diet was getting this resurgence of popularity, I'd have people come in and say, I'm not eating any carbs all day long. I'm eating 20 grams of carbs a day, and I'll show you how to count that in just a second. And they're still gaining weight or they're not losing weight. Well, what are you eating? Well, they're having 3 sirloin steaks for dinner. Well, there's still fat in that, and there's still calories in that. A calorie is a calorie. So as you start to read labels, and it says sugar-free or no sugar added, I got a slide on this as well, make sure you look at the calories, because they're starting to market to everybody that's pre-diabetic and diabetic. And if it's got a calorie in it, it's going here if you eat too many of them. It's basic math. If you eat more than what your body needs, you're gonna gain weight. So Thanksgiving is not an all-access pass to gluttony and guilt-free eating. I mean, there's some repercussions of that, particularly those that are diabetic, if they're on insulin pumps or they're taking insulin or they're having other agents. The next thing is, I just modify these traditional dishes. Like I said, you don't have to put 2 sticks of butter in the dressing. You don't have to. I mean, some of these traditional foods, again, growing up in the South, if it doesn't taste good, it probably wasn't made with fat or grease or, you know, whatever they did. But you don't have to tell anybody, because if you tell somebody they're eating something healthy, for some reason they'll have, well, it doesn't taste right. You know, it's like, well, don't tell them. I mean, I know that's a little tricky, but it still gets people to be a little bit more healthier. And my kids won't care. I don't think my dad would either. He wouldn't even notice. There are also foods that are higher in fiber that actually help satiate the appetite. So if it's green and grows above the ground, it's low in carbs, except peas. Peas is the only thing that's really got a little bit of carbohydrates to them. So if it's green and grows above the ground, it's got lower in carbs. If it's white, it's got carbohydrates, bread, rice, pasta, potatoes. I mean, it's got all carbs in it. So if you're going to eat carbohydrates, maybe eat something that's going to avoid, if you're diabetic, again, to avoid these really high spikes of sugar. So maybe having some snacks of some green veggies or something before that. It's about the only go green I think is a reasonable thing to do. But anyway, instead of these sweet mashed potatoes, it was just my point on that. Here's the desserts. So you, as I said earlier about the sugar substitute, wait a couple hours after eating dinner. I had a diabetic come to me not too long ago. He had this box of candy he brought me. I'm like, that's pretty bold. Bring your doctor a box of candy. You know, I don't have desserts like donuts and stuff like that broad. But I notice in diabetes, there's a test called an A1C, and it tells you what your 3-month average sugar is. His previous A1C was in the low 6 range, which was pretty good, and it went up to almost 10. And I'm thinking, what happened, Steve? He says, well, I found this wonderful chocolate that has no sugar in it. And if you look on it, it says no sugar added. Each piece was 130 calories. And he was eating like a box of these things a day because he said, they're so good. I can't believe there's no sugar in these things. I said, there's sugar in it. So they may disguise it as, you know, corn syrup or high fructose or whatever they want to consume it as. But if it's got calories in it, it's going to have some effect on your glucose. If it's higher in protein or higher in fiber or it's got some of these other things, it'll have a slower effect on it. And I'll show you some things in a minute with this in just a second. Smaller portion of dessert if it's not something that's been made with some of these sugar substitutes. There are actually food psychologists, and the food psychologists will actually tell you that if you're in a restaurant, say you go to any restaurant, why do you think they show you the food or the dessert? They come out with this big tray of desserts, and they can't just say chocolate cake. They've got to say molten chocolate, whatever, and they go in this description. So you're hearing it, you're seeing it, and you're smelling it. Again, it's appealing to the senses. How would anybody in their right mind be able to turn that down? I mean, I don't understand. I guess I try to empathize a little bit with alcoholics or drug addicts on how you might not be able to, you know, but that's an abstinence thing. I can't abstain from chocolate. I think it should be a vitamin. I think that's a very important vitamin to be on. So if I see a regular dessert, the food psychologist will tell you is if you take 1 or 2 bites of the dessert or you eat one or two bites of the substance that you're trying to avoid, you're actually getting that satiation of that desire to eat that, whatever it is you like. So there'd be a little piece of chocolate or whether it be some stuffing. Again, you don't have to have the gargantuan size and just eat until the plate is clean and lick the plate. You can actually reasonably eat a small amount of it and still enjoy the experience of having, you know, Aunt Nellie's chocolate dessert or pecan pie or whatever they're having. And I said about exercise too. I think that's I don't want to overestimate that too much. Is there anybody that thinks that bread is not good? I mean, warm bread out of the oven with butter on it is absolutely my favorite thing to eat. And I bet other than a potato, I mean, I think those two things are pretty good. So it's delicious to eat it. But again, you want to try to limit on how much. As far as avoiding bread and gravy and stuff like that, I don't know how successful you'll be with that during Thanksgiving holidays. But, you know, pick one or the other. You don't have to consume the bread and the stuffing and the dessert and all those different things. As I said earlier, a third a cup of stuffing has 40 grams of carbohydrates, which is about a cup of ice cream, depending on which ice cream you have. You can also bake the stuffing in a casserole dish rather than stick it inside the turkey, because when you do that, you get the drippings of the fat and all that kind of stuff. And that sounds kind of disgusting right now, but it sure does taste good, you know, when you pull it out of the turkey. But again, fat, as I said, has more calories than anything that we can have, whether it be protein or carbohydrates, and that's going to add more to the calories. The dinner rolls, this is a suggestion. Can I do it? It's pretty tough. But if I eat just half the roll, I'm still getting the bread without abstaining from it, and I still feel like I'm still getting some of the bread. The gravy thing, I don't quite understand the gravy thing. I mean, we're taking something that's really good, it's high in protein, it's healthy to eat, and we're putting gravy on top of it. It's probably just a habit. It's just like sitting down and starting to eat, and you start putting salt on something before you even taste it. Why do you do that? I mean, it's just a habit of actually going through this process. So gravies are loaded with calories because mostly it's fat. As I said earlier, be practical. Don't be punitive. Have something that's durable. Set yourself up for success rather than feeling guilty about what you didn't do. Anybody wants these slides, I'll send them to you. If you give me your email, just write your email down and you can have these slides. Strategic planning is the key, and that's what I do every single day. I don't get the diabetic on one drug typically. I get the diabetic is on a list of medications. They don't want to take shots. They're gaining weight. They feel like crap. The neuropathies bother them. They're on, you know, whatever it is. They're having all these problems, but that's what I'm doing every single day. I'm trying to strategize with that patient saying, look, how can we take the least amount of drugs? How do we get you to lose weight and have better control? There's no magic in that. It's hard work trying to get to that, but you got to have a strategy. My strategy is twofold: fix what's broke and keep things from breaking. If I do my job right, over a period of years, the weight goes down, less medications, better control, feel better, but you're doing it by three things: teaching people to eat correctly, give them a structured, again, non-punitive environment to do that. And we have dietitians and exercise physiologists in my group, in my clinic. I've got someone there that's a non-militant dietitian. She's very healthy, but she's not militant with things, because sometimes there's a lot of condescension when I inherit diabetics. They've been, you know, I had a patient today that the sugar went up and said, well, I don't know what I did. I mean, you see all the guilt and feeling bad. It's like, you may have did nothing. I mean, if your body can't process what you're eating, your glucose can go up with doing nothing. He's a physician, actually. This guy, I mean, he should know. And I said, look, if I sit, and we talked about this, I talked about this talk, I said, if I sit at Thanksgiving dinner and I eat whatever I want, I could eat two plates, I could eat four desserts, I could eat all the bread I wanted, drink all the booze I wanted, my glucose is still perfectly controlled. And the difference is because I'm not a diabetic and I'm not insulin resistant. You could be perfectly controlled diabetic and you could eat something that your body doesn't process, still eat the right amount of grams of carbohydrates, and your sugar can go to 200 for no unexplained reason other than your body can't process that. And what that means to me, if you're eating correctly, is the medications are not appropriate and your body does not have the intrinsic ability to fix that. So there are things that I have, my cholesterol is really high. And it doesn't matter if I ride my bike between here and Eagle River where I live, it's 17 miles round trip. So I can exercise like that, I can run 5 miles a day, I can eat correctly, my cholesterol is still high. There's some things that you cannot explain other than it's how we're hardwired. It's what our genetics are, and it's what our ethnicity is. But the strategic planning is different for every single person because we all have different hurdles we have to overcome. Some guys, I gotta just quit having them have their root beer floats at night before they go to bed. I mean, just some simple basic things that we all know pretty much a lot of things that I'm saying, but having a structured environment to do that and holding you accountable to that and objectifying what that is, there's a real art to that. And again, I don't know if I've got it all figured out, but at least I've got success after success where I can see where we try to get people to do that. And medications are getting a little bit easier to help people get control as well. Now, one of the things is that I say with this plan of action, you can embrace the holidays and the festivities for what they are. Think about, why are we getting together for Thanksgiving? What is the true essence of the holiday? I mean, I don't want to get to a spiritual level here, but I mean, that's kind of what we're doing. We're being thankful for the things, and it's not about just sitting down and be gluttonous and eat all we want. It's about enjoying our family after the alcohol, I think, and enjoying the holiday festivities for what they are. So just kind of think about what we're trying to do. And then remember to get back on track for some reason if you get off track. And so if you listen to what I say, you come with a plan, and you actually just blow it on that day, well, tomorrow's a new day. I think the hardest thing about getting back on track is just, like exercise, is the hardest thing I think with exercise is just putting your shoes on. Once the shoes go on, I'm committed. But the thought of like, oh, I got to exercise, got to find the time for that, it gets harder and harder, particularly when I get at work at 6:30 and I get home at 6:30, 7 o'clock tonight, 8 o'clock, whatever. So just get back on track and try to micromanage yourself at a one thing at a time. Everybody's a little bit different. We have different ethnic and cultural likes. I had a guy today from the Philippines in my office. He used to eat rice 3 times a day. Again, if you look at a cup of rice, one cup of rice has twice as much carbohydrates in it than a cup of ice cream. So if you came to the doctor and said, I'm eating 3 bowls of ice cream a day, I cannot figure out why my diabetes isn't controlled. Well, but if you say, am I going to tell somebody that has rice in their culture to say, never eat rice again, or never to have this or that? You're not going to do that. What you have to do is you got to figure out how to modify that, be culturally responsible and respectful, and how to modify the medications and different things to try to be more successful. So that's we all have different things, but it's a very individual disease. And some of these tips may work for some and may not work for others, but the primary bottom line is we all have to have the determination and will to do that. And you've got to have not only your strategy based on what you know you need to do, but have a long-term strategy and say, what motivates me? What motivates me to take these shots? What motivates me to eat correctly? What motivates me to do the right thing? It may be a spiritual thing. It may be a narcissistic thing. It may be you want to see your kids grow up. You've got to find out what that carrot in front of the mule is to get us to do what we need to do, because every diabetic I've ever met eventually gets tired of being a diabetic. I had a diabetic today. He's had it 54 years. I mean, that's a long time to be sticking yourself. So why do you do that? Why do you go through that process? It's not because your doctor's threatening you that you can go blind, you're going to have kidney failure. We all know these kinds of things. But what you have to do is you have to implement this kind of plan of action, and you have to have the determination to be healthy for whatever motivates you as an individual. Because it's a very difficult disease to just go through life saying, you've got to do this, you've got to do this, just because you're supposed to. What I'd recommend also, these are some basic principles. As I say, consult with your doctor or your mid-level, your PA or nurse practitioner, whoever manages your diabetes, and say that, what can I do? What can I do for Thanksgiving or holidays or some of these times that I have trouble? You know, my trouble is not these kind of holidays. My trouble is fishing on the Kenai or doing different things when I'm away from home, where I'm not necessarily in control of always my meal plan. But if I had those kind of issues, I'd have to try to figure out somehow how I can still embrace my fishing habit as well as my eating likes and dislikes. And that's what I recommend you guys to do. Talk with your individual doctor who knows you better and say, what can I do because I'm having trouble with this? And be honest with them. Say, I eat a bag of Cheetos every night before I go to bed. Whatever it is, if they're judgmental, it's time to get a new doctor. But find someone that's going to help you with that and say, these are my challenges and this is what I'm having trouble with. And then lastly, like I said, be thankful. So here's three websites. I'm going to go through two of these with you. The eatright.org is the American Dietetic Association. I think that's a fairly good website. I like the last one the best, and these are all free websites. So eatright.org is the Dietetic Association. Diabetes.org is the American Diabetes Association. We're going to go through that in just a second. And then calorieking.com is a website that you can count your calories, and that I think it's the most useful because it gives you the most basic information, and you can individualize it, and it shows you how many calories you're eating, how many carbs you're eating, how much exercise it does to cancel that out. So we're gonna look at some of those things right here. All right. So here's the American Diabetes Association, the diabetes.org. So if you go under food and fitness, and you go under planning your meals, you can click on this. And what it does is it you can just kind of scroll down through here again, and it tells you about holiday meal planning right there, meal planning for vegetarians. I have a lot of type 1 diabetics that have celiac disease, that have a gluten sensitivity, and there's gluten-free diets. Carbohydrate counting, I like this website. I'm going to show you a second, a little bit better than this. It explains what glycemic index, and I'll explain to you in simple terms what a glycemic index is. These diets that are advertised, like Jenny Craig and Nutrisystems for diabetics, these diets are designed by dietitians and physicians to help people lose weight without starving them. And so that's an idea. I mean, if you're hungry, intrinsically will want to eat. And how they do it is it has a lower carbohydrate, lower glycemic index. And glycemic index is a value. If you actually just Google glycemic index, there's a lot of free databases. You can look up any food. And the glycemic index has to do with how fast your body breaks down carbohydrates. So if you have a complex carbohydrate or you have a simple carbohydrate, the faster the carbohydrate's broken down, it starts in the mouth. So the saliva that we have, there's an enzyme in the mouth that breaks down some of the carbohydrates. It goes into our stomach, and then it goes into the intestines. And the faster it goes from our lips to the intestines is how that sugar gets absorbed. So a simple carbohydrate has a higher glycemic index. So for instance, let's just go over fruit. Watermelon has a glycemic index of about 102. Cherries has a glycemic index of 32. Anything that's around 70 or less is lower in glycemic index. It's kind of like the bigger the fruit, almost, the more the glycemic index is a rough kind of. So cantaloupe, mangoes, things like that have a high glycemic index. Cherries, fruits like apples and oranges. Grapefruit's actually the only kind of outlier of that. It's a bigger fruit, but it has one of the lower glycemic index, and that's some of the reasons why the lower glycemic index with that fruit is why there's some grapefruit diets and things like that where people can lose weight. But the higher the glycemic index, as my sugar starts to climb, my body's got to make insulin. So if I have a high carbohydrate, high glycemic index food, my sugar goes up really quick, my body makes a lot of insulin, and as it does that, then what happens is the sugar starts dropping pretty quick, and it may drop too low until my insulin starts to get lower here. And if you have this reactive hypoglycemia, what happens is that about 2 hours later, you're hungry again. So things that have high fructose corn syrup and some of these other things in it stimulates insulin production. And diabetics that have to require insulin or have to take more insulin because of the higher glycemic index, it's almost impossible to lose weight. It's almost impossible for the type 2 diabetics. Type 1 diabetes is a little bit different. And on insulin pumps with type 1 diabetics, what we'll do is we can program the pump to give insulin based on their glycemic index and how much carbohydrates they have, because that's how the human body does it. So if we have something that's predominantly carbohydrates, we get a huge surge of insulin. If we have something that's predominantly fat, we don't get the surge. We kind of have a longer lasting insulin over a period of time. But our body will automatically do that if we're not diabetic. If somebody's pre-diabetic and they're having lots of carbohydrates and high glycemic index, you're surging in insulin, and it makes you want to have to eat about every couple hours because you're getting hungry a lot, and you get this rebound kind of problem. So it explains that in here. Another website I'll give you is the website of my office, and it's called diabetesalaska.com. If you go to diabetesalaska.com, it talks about all these dietary things in simple verbiage about, you know, explaining it just a little bit different than this if you want to look at that. Let's look at Calorie King here. So this is what Calorie King is. Again, these are free websites. So if we look at, let's look up pumpkin pie, made from recipe, made from scratch. So basically, if you look at this, it says one piece of pumpkin pie, one piece, not half the pie. So one piece is 316 calories and 40 grams of carbohydrates. Now you can look at fat and you can look at all these different things, but I get people to count carbs and calories to make it simple. Now, if you want to learn about trans fats and saturated fats, I can, over a period of time, I can teach that to my patients. But what I do is just look at the carbs and look at the calories, because you can't have something, like for instance, what I do for a lot of diabetics, I'll say, look, for a meal, maybe have around 500 to 600 calories per meal with about 50 to 60 grams of carbs should be the most you should eat. If you want to eat less, that's fine. But if you have something like, say, steak, if you look up here, let's just look up steak. And I'll just pick any steak. Let's just pick a filet mignon. So you have 4 ounces. Now you can go up here and you can change, say, well, you know, we got to supersize it, right? Because, you know, 8 ounces is really not that big, but 400 calories, but no grams of carbs. So people that eat these low carbohydrate meals say, well, I'm not eating any carbs, but there's still calories there. And if you eat these calories, you can see at the bottom, it says, you want to burn these calories? 113 minutes of walking, 46 minutes of jogging, 34 minutes of swimming, or 62 minutes of cycling. Take your pick. And like, well, I don't know if it's worth 46 minutes of jogging. You have to make that decision. If you're going to neutralize what you just ate with no carbs, you're still going to have to exercise. If you look at, let's look at something like, let's look at a Big Mac. I don't want to show you what the meals are. That's so here's a Big Mac. So 540 calories, 45 grams of carbs. Okay? So again, you can see that the calories, the carbohydrates are not much more than what the pumpkin pie is, but there's a whole lot more fat. And look, it's about 45% of the fat that you would need in a whole entire day just in the burger, not counting the fries and whatever else there is. Here's another one that I like. This is the one I use a lot that a lot of people just don't, they can't believe it. So here's a muffin. And I'm not talking about the muffins that are like the size of your head at Costco. I'm talking about just a regular muffin. Let's look at, here's a muffin at Starbucks. So there's 360 calories and there's 59 grams of carbs. 360 calories, 59 grams of carbs. Let's look up a donut just for comparison. So we'll go with Krispy Kreme, which is, we don't have those, but so 200 calories, 22 grams of carbs. So one muffin is the same as 3 donuts. So look it up, because what you think may be healthy for you may have a lot of hidden carbohydrates in it. And if you're taking insulin, the proper way to take insulin is you take a certain amount of insulin for how many carbohydrates you're eating. If you're eating 120 grams of carbs, you're eating 10 grams of carbs. If you're exercising, if your sugar's high, if it's low, you have to adjust that, because my body will do that naturally. Just like I said, if I eat whatever I want, my sugar's the same. If I eat nothing, my sugar's the same. I have different hormones in my body that will regulate that normally. And it's not just insulin and the food that I'm eating. There's glucagon, there's cortisol, there's other hormones that keep all this nice and straight. So let's look up something else. Look at Egg McMuffin. That's another one I get a lot. McMuffin. I'm just going to show you something here. So let's look at just the sausage egg McMuffin. This kind of goes back to the carbs and the fat. So just the sausage egg McMuffin is 450 calories and it's 30 grams of carbs. And if we go back to this, to this other one, and let's just use the Egg McMuffin, you got less calories, but the same grant of carbs. The reason why you have less calories is because you took the meat off of it and the fatty meat. So it's the same amount of carbs. So if you look at milk does the same thing. People drink skim milk versus whole milk. The difference is the fat. The carbs are the same in all the milks. Okay, some of the soy milks and some of those things are different. But 0.5% of milk has the same amount of sugar in it as 3.5% milk, which is whole milk. So just read the label. And I, like I said, rough estimate, everybody's different, but around 50 to 60 grams of carbs is generally plenty. So a bowl of cereal, for a normal size bowl, not the big Jethro bowl, you know, the normal size, is, you know, everybody know the Clampets, you know, the Jethro bowl? I said that to a younger, he didn't know who the Clampets were. I'm like, okay, whatever. But just a normal size bowl, if you get your cereal and put that in there, it's about 50 grams, 60 grams. But it generally has a high glycemic index. If we go to, let me just go to this website. I'll go to diabetesalaska.com here. Okay, so this is the website that I wrote. If you go to diabetes, and there's a thing just on type 1, and there's also on type 2, but we're just, since we're talking about this, we're just going to go into dietary considerations. There's a thing about alcohol and diabetes, what are carbohydrates, just getting more conscious. And then this is just explaining glycemic index, but I have a table here that I want to show you, as we talked about that. Because this goes to the discussion about cereal. You can see, like, Special K right there has a glycemic index of 77. Look over in the next column. Cheerios is 106. Just regular cornflakes, 114. You can have the same amount of carbs, but have a higher glycemic index. You're going to be hungrier later, and you're going to need more insulin as a diabetic, although it's the same amount of carbs. So just be aware of the glycemic index and the carbohydrates as you're thinking about doing this plan, not just for Thanksgiving. So just to give you some resources. You can Google this glycemic index and something else will come up differently, but think that's about it. So what I wanted to do, just in closing, is I wanted to everybody should have this thing. This is from the state of Alaska. And this just, if you are a diabetic, if you followed what this says on this sheet, just in general, and hold your doctor accountable for what it says on here and say, hey, you've never done this. How come you haven't, you know, whatever. I mean, it's not to make, you know, put them on the spot, but it's to educate you about what you need to know as a diabetic, or if you're in the pre-diabetic state, how do you make the diagnosis of diabetes? So up until June of 2009, there was only three ways of diagnosing diabetes. Now, as you can see, this has been updated, and now, bless you, it can show you, it can use the A1C to diagnose diabetes. But there's a whole host of things on here. Who to screen? How do you diagnose pre-diabetes? What do we recommend as far as blood pressure, weight, checking your feet, physical exams? It's just real basic. I mean, it's not that complicated to look at that. It's your body. You're responsible for your health care, not your doctor. What you do is you find out what you're supposed to have, and you go to him or her, and you say, look, these are some things that I'd like to put on my list of what I want to do. Maybe this be your New Year's resolution to figure out how you actually get more involved with your health care and be proactive with it. So it's all about educating you and educating who's taking care of you if you need to. So I'll take questions now, and I didn't know who's going to come tonight, so I don't know how to prepare one of these talks other than say, eat right, exercise, and you know. But hopefully that made this a little bit more, you know, it's an hour. I can't beat you guys up for more than that much time. So if you guys have questions or comments or so, I appreciate those now.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA with Dr. Ross Tanner, the founder of the Diabetes and Lipid Clinic of Alaska. His health talk on Rethinking the Thanksgiving Feast was recorded at Providence Hospital in Anchorage on Monday, November 15th. We have links to Dr. Tanner's slideshow presentation and all of the websites he reviewed during the presentation at kska.org. Following his talk on diabetes, cholesterol, and the holidays, Dr. Tanner responded to questions from audience members.
Right.
Your opinion on that?
So the question was, should you eat? Him and his wife are both diabetic. They have getting different information with regards to how to eat. One thinks that maybe small, frequent meals. The other one's taking three meals a day, traditional way. I would say do what you think is right for you. I mean, for me, I've got patients that have never, ever eaten breakfast. Just don't eat it. Maybe don't even eat lunch. They just have one large meal a day. The problem with just skipping a meal, for one, we'll get to the question in a second, is that if I say, look, I want you to have 50 grams of carbs per meal, 150 a day, pretty generous. Again, I'm just generalizing because everybody's a little different with this. I'm just picking a number. Skipping breakfast and lunch and having 150 grams at supper, again, you're loading your body with that carb. So it's like saying, can you walk 3 miles or run 3 miles backwards at 10,000 feet? I mean, it's what your body's capable of processing at that time. The pancreas is going to do better with less stress at one time. So if you're having 25 grams of carbohydrates 6 times a day compared to 50 grams 3 times a day, it might be better for that person. It kind of depends. I can't eat 25 grams at one time. I'm going to eat 50 per time. So I may have the intention of having 6 small meals, but it may be 6 big meals if I eat that way. So I don't do that for myself. I get up in the morning, have my breakfast. I have my, you know, light something in the midday. If I get something today, I had a can of smoked salmon. And then at supper, I'll have a meat and 2 veggies. I mean, that's kind of what I'll do. So what you do is you count your carbs. You know, talk with your doctor about, or a dietitian, about what your limitations are. And say, this is how you should eat. And then glycemic index. I wouldn't count glycemic index before I counted carbs. I just look at carbs and calories. Then I would look at the type of carbohydrates that I ate. I mean, you got to start somewhere. So she might be better eating 6 small meals, and you might be better eating 3 small meals. But, you know, the answer to your question is your wife is always right. So I don't know which one she said, but she's right. So anyway, but again, you have to adjust the medications to what you're doing as well, because, you know, it may vary. Some people, like, I've got people work on the slope. You know, the 2 weeks up there, they may be different compared to 2 weeks at home. And sometimes home's worse. It kind of depends. But most of the time, going the slope, it's harder. Our shift workers, you know, you may not be able to work. I had a guy today, he gets off work at 11, and literally he says, I eat my entire calories between 11 o'clock at night and 1 o'clock in the morning, then I go to bed. Yikes. You know, he's not controlled. But, you know, it's hard to break some of these habits. Again, so where am I going to start with him? I can start small places, you know, small areas. So again, men, don't eat after 8 o'clock if you're going to bed around 10 or 11. Watch the large portions late at night and watch the snacking. I mean, if I start getting hungry around 10 o'clock, I just go to bed. I mean, I'll survive through the night. I'm not going to starve. So, I mean, if you have diabetes and you're taking insulin, you might, you know, be aware of low sugars and getting nocturnally hypoglycemic. Kind of depends on the medications you're taking, things like that. But that everybody's individual with that. So it's there's two thoughts to that, but both of them are kind of right. Kind of depends on what's right for you. So the question is about how much exercise, how often, and how much. Generally, just general speaking, depending on patients' ages and different physical limitations, and also where you're starting at. Some people just walking, you know, to the refrigerator can be considered exercise, which they do all the time. But generally speaking, I say 150 minutes a week is what you should do for most people. And again, you have to be careful because when I talked about a stress test earlier, if you do a stress test, I do stress tests for 2-3 different reasons. If somebody has a high pretest probability of having a positive stress test, which means they've smoked 3 packs per day, have uncontrolled diabetes, have high blood pressure, or have some other test that tells me they may have vascular disease, I'll do a stress test even though they're not having any symptoms. The second person I'll do it in is someone that's having symptoms. So if you come in and say, I got chest pain, it's going to my left arm, I need to determine whether or not that person's having chest pain related to their heart. And the third person I do is somebody that maybe has never exercised for the last 20 years, and I want to see if they're going to be safe during exercise, because many patients that I take care of, and I'll do a stress test on them, is that their blood pressure sitting in my office may be 130 over 80. Not perfect, but pretty good. And they get on a stress test and it'll go 220 over 120. They're very deconditioned. And when they're exercising, that particular person is doing damage to their body. But if they didn't do a stress test or they didn't see what their blood pressure is or maybe what their pulse is during the exercise, they may never know it. It's like saying, well, my glucose in the doctor's office is always 100, but your A1C is 12. Well, it's up sometimes. So it's a very dynamic process. And with exercise, as I say, 30 minutes a day, 5 times a week, that'd be about 150 minutes a week. And they've done this in women because now we're getting more and more concern with what's happening in the baby boomer women as they're aging. This is the number one killer in that group is heart disease. It's not breast cancer. It's not these, I think we're just out. Oh, good. It's not breast cancer. It's not colon cancer. It's not leukemia. It's cardiovascular disease is the number one killer. Why is it continuing to rise when we've got statins? We got 10 statins we can write. We got doctors give you all kinds of drugs, but you guys are still dying at higher rates. Why is that happening? Because it's not a medication deficiency, it's about our lifestyle. And the manifestation of all of these things as it relates to what is diabetes, pre-diabetes, cholesterol, blood pressure. If you end up getting a drug for diabetes, not a drug, say 3 drugs, 2 drugs for cholesterol, 2 drugs for blood pressure, treat the central problem. The central problem is what I've been talking about for the last, you know, hour or so. So as we get people to start exercising, I start slowly. And say, look, if you can't exercise but 5 minutes and get winded and short of breath and or you have something else, then do 5 minutes twice a day, 3 times a day, and slowly but surely kind of increase that over a period of time. Because if you're 20 years old or if you're 60 years old or you're 90 years old, you're going to have different limitations and different expectations. But you got to start somewhere if you're not doing anything. The thing I was going to say about women, the American Heart Association has a program called Go Red. If you look at the American Heart Association, just go to the website. They have it every year here in February is Heart Month. And there's 1,000 women. I've given talks in front of that group. And it's a very proactive group of people. And they all have stories. There's the first year I gave a talk, there was a woman. She was the first gold medalist from Alaska named Kristen Thorsness. She has probably 4% body fat. She exercises all the time, and she's already had a heart attack in her 40s. Why? I mean, her blood pressure is normal, cholesterol. I mean, why are we seeing these kinds of things? Well, that's certainly not dietary and sedentary activity. It's genetic. So when you're trying to manage somebody's risk, you have to define what the risk is rather than saying, eat right, exercise, just take these medicines, and everything will be fine. When we look at statin, like Lipitor, Zocor, these kinds of drugs, every group that's ever been studied in has helped. High risk, low risk, medium risk. But when you say 30% risk reduction, you're talking about 30% of what? If you're smoking and overweight and diabetic, 30% risk reduction, that person's a big bang for your buck. If you look at exercise in women, if you do that 150 minutes a week, it's a 50% risk reduction. It doesn't matter if you swim, run, or walk. 150 minutes a week is a 50% risk reduction of cardiovascular events. Not risk reduction, events. Because all these studies have been designed to say, hey, your cholesterol's better, your blood pressure's better. But there's manipulation of statistics based on market and drug and all that kind. I'm not getting into conspiracy theory or anything, but I want to know at the end of the study how many people are alive. Because you can have a heart attack on Lipitor, and you can not have a heart attack and have high cholesterol and not be on a statin. So that's the guess is who's going to have the event. All I can say is this is how one should eat. This is how one should exercise. Based on the biochemical abnormalities that I see in their blood test, based on what medications I'll implement, if the diet and exercise is not doing what it should be. Just like with me with high cholesterol. I take 3 drugs for my cholesterol. And it's impossible to control it without it. But my cholesterol is normal. But if I don't take it, it's high, even despite doing the right thing, doing the exact same thing. So the answer to that question is kind of detailed, but it's about 120, 150 minutes a week. And you got to start somewhere. Make sure it's safe for you to exercise before you start some, you know, vigorous exercise program.
Is that the same for men and women?
It's about the same for men, yeah. I mean, again, I don't deal with absolutes because you say 150 minutes, once they hit 150 minutes, they're done. I got some, yes, do what you like. I mean, start somewhere. I'd say that'd be the minimum. So if someone wants to be, you know, they want to try a different diet or they want to start exercising, use a trainer or they want to lift weights. All right. I'm talking about aerobic exercise, getting your pulse up. If you want to calculate what your pulse should be, there's a formula we use. It's not too difficult. It's 220 minus your age times 85%. That's for men. 220 minus your age times 85%. That should be once you reach that, that's your maximum heart rate is what I think. You shouldn't go much higher than that if you're exercising. You multiply that number by another 85%, and that's what women should be. That's kind of your maximum. But it varies with your age, and it varies with your physical issues. So I'm just saying, in general, that's what we look at. So the younger you are, the more your heart rate can go up. The older you are, I mean, gosh, if you're 98, you might be done by the time you just walk to the refrigerator. I mean, it kind of depends on the person. But think about this. Think about people that are in their 90s. Think about the behaviors. Not all of them, because I got some people say, yeah, grandma smoked till she was 97. I mean, notwithstanding, most people that live into their 90s are very healthy. They got good genes. They picked the right parents. But they usually didn't smoke. They're generally not overweight. They've probably never taken a drug in their life. I mean, they have a lot of, you can just look at what those people do. They stay active intellectually and physically. They're moving more. They're eating right. They do the right thing. They're not eating processed food and they're moving. So as far as exercise, I just say in general, about 150 minutes a week. It's about 30 minutes a day of doing some vigorous activity. And what I think it does is that I look at that calorie king and say, look, when I get off my treadmill, it tells me how many calories exactly I've burned off. That gives me a license to steal 500 calories away, I think. You know, but if you don't do it, and I didn't burn off 500 calories, and then I ate a bowl of ice cream at night, I think I'm ahead 1,000. So it's a balancing that, it's a balancing act of what you're trying to figure out of how much to exercise and how I do that. So I'm really good Sunday through Thursday. I somehow can never get exercise on Friday because I'm always doing something, and Saturday I'm doing something too. So I usually do Sunday night through Thursday nights what I do in the wintertime, because when it gets dark, I get the seasonal affective stuff where I'm going to start eating and sleeping. So I just exercise when I get home. In the summertime, I do it in the morning, because who wants to exercise, regimented exercise, in the summer? I mean, I may be playing basketball 11 o'clock at night because it's fun, not because I'm supposed to do something, and it's daylight. So everybody has different things they like and dislike. I mean, if you hate climbing stairs, then don't buy a stair stepper. If you hate a treadmill, then get an elliptical. If you hate elliptical, get a bicycle, do something. But it's going to be a little painful. I don't like that no pain, no gain stuff, but you're going to have to be somewhat regimented and have that strategy just like you will on Thanksgiving Day. So.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA with Dr. Ross Tanner, the founder of the Diabetes and Lipid Clinic of Alaska. You can find his presentation on Rethinking the Thanksgiving Feast on KSKA.org, along with all of the helpful websites he reviewed during the presentation. Providence Hospital hosted Dr. Tanner's Health Talk on diabetes, cholesterol, and the holidays at the Providence Cancer Center on Monday, November 15th, 2010. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.